Welcome to Rewatchable, episode 56, where we're rewatching Pushing Daisies. Today we're going to be talking about episode 9, Corpsicle. As always, you can email us any comments, questions, feedback at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at re_watchable, and this post will be available on hypeable.com. So, welcome to the season finale of season one. Only 9 episodes, but we're ready to just dive in and talk about it. So this episode is entitled Corpsicle, and the synopsis, going off of the executive order issued in last week's episode, that the synopses should rhyme. I have done my worst to make this rhyme and made it painful for everyone involved. So here's the synopsis for Corpsicle. The finale is here. The insurance world is struck with fear. So listen and gather round. Their agents are nowhere to be found. As the knight settled for the pie maker last week, wishing she could plant one kiss on his rosy cheek, Chuck gazed into Ned's big brown eyes. Ned, in turn, reveals a 20-year lie. Storming over to Olive Snook, Chuck seeks revenge from her brewing hate. Giving Digby's ass a good look, she notices some missing hair tied to her fate. The facts are these, all killed with kindness, if you please. 3 frozen corpsicles found in the snow, but who is the killer? That's what we need to know. Emerson and Ned seek out a boy in need of a heart, but the insurance agents denied him his fresh start. Snarky, some may say. Yes, he was hard to appease. Wouldn't you if you wanted the chance for a reprise? Wish-a-wish lady tried and was clever. A monkey, a tap show, a murderous endeavor. Meanwhile, a secret slip of Cod's kin pushes Ned to pry answers before the episode is fin. Chuck wishes to see her father one last time, but Ned refuses to revisit his innocent crime. The darling mermaid darlings accept another pie from the pie maker so charming, enjoying their drugs and return to the water. Lily eats it entirely, revealing Chuck is her daughter. That's it for season 1, 9 episodes down, but the discussion's just begun. I welcome Mitch, Colleen, and Karen, and I'm your host, Brittany, who is completely out of rhymes.
Yeah!
Oh my
Great.
God, that's so good!
That's very impressive. Good job.
I was exhausted just reading it in the doc. I don't know how long that must have taken you.
It was okay. I'm a big fan of Dr. Seuss, so luckily once I started going, it was pretty good.
Oh, that's good.
All right, well, I'm done. You guys can talk now. I'm just kidding. All right, so that was the finale. 9 episodes.
Ta-da.
That's it. That so the writer's strike happened as this show was on from 2007 to 2008. So this episode aired in December, as you can probably tell because of the snow, in 2007, and then the show was originally picked up for 22 episodes, but it never came back to air in 2008 because no one could write anything. So they kind of had to, Brian Fuller wrote that ending in really quickly to make it a cliffhanger, even though it wasn't meant to be. It was supposed to just be a mid-season type of break. So do you guys think that 9 was enough? I know that, Karen, you commented you thought there would be 11 episodes last week. Do you think that 9 was a good place to stop in terms of looking back, or do you think that a 22-episode run would have kind of tired out the show?
I feel kind of bad saying this, but I do kind of feel like 9 was enough just because I still don't really know how I feel about the show. I definitely don't hate it at all. I think that there are some really great parts to it, but I was kind of ready for season 1 to be over with. And I think where they stopped it with the cliffhanger was actually a really good place to kind of jump into season 2. And I guess it's going to sort of depend on how season 2 picks up and how they go from there to so I can really decide how I feel about this finale, like if it's a good enough transition. But even though I didn't particularly love the episode, I think in terms of it being the finale, it was okay.
I think it's just such a bummer, like, for everyone involved in the show, or really any new show of that season, that, like, oh, yay, you know, we got a full pickup for a full season for, you know, 22 episodes. And then, oh, wait, there's this strike. We only get to do 9. So, like, that's going to mess up the flow of any show. So they really, I mean, this wasn't one of the stronger episodes, which is unfortunate because it's the finale. Ended up being the finale, but they had to sort of make it a finale when it wasn't intended to be one originally. So it just, I think it's such a bummer, you know, a show that ended up having such a short run. You really wonder how much this had to do with it, that their first season only got to be 9 episodes.
And they didn't crazy, get to do. But I really, really, really loved the ending as it was. And I felt that it felt organic. And maybe is because they did just take what was meant to be a mid-season break and make that their season finale. But I thought that it was excellent. I really was into it. I thought that the drama all clicked in nicely. I won't jump ahead to all the big notes on the big reveals in this episode, but I'm happy that they happened when they did, because it really made me feel like the writers were looking to punch you in the gut right before you were going to have Pushing Daisies for like another year when the show was still airing.
Yeah. I definitely agree with Mitch, only because I think that 9 felt like, it didn't feel like enough at the time when I was watching it, because I was really bummed that it wasn't coming back for so long.
Me
but
too.
I think that the where they ended in, they only had, like, Brian Fuller was sort of just like, I need to write a kind of cliffhanger now, and it wasn't originally in the plan, but I think that they handled it really well, because you start to have, like, this change in the characters, and you are left wondering, like, oh, well, now we have an Emerson backstory. Now we have this. Now we have all these other things to go off of. So I thought that they did a good job of sort of just, like, throwing a lot at you and making you want to come back for season 2.
Definitely.
Okay, so speaking of the cliffhanger, what did we think of it? Did we like it?
Yes. I think that the cliffhanger was probably the highlight of this episode for me, because I felt like it was a bit anticlimactic with what was going on with Chuck and her trying to deal with everything that was happening, which, like you said, could have been due to the writer's strike and, you know, all this other stuff going on. So I definitely agree that they did really well with what they had, and it's just unfortunate the situation they were in. But aside from all of that, the cliffhanger was something that I never saw coming, and it was also something that made me excited for season 2, so I guess it kind of served its purpose for me.
You know what, Karen? It hit me right at the right time in the show, because I was just asking myself in this episode, what happened to Chuck's mom? Because we're learning so much about what happened right after her dad passed, and the fact that she went right to her aunt's immediately the day of, it just kind of smelt fishy. And I'm glad to see that my Veronica Mars sleuthing nose is still sniffing out the right clues.
Actually, that's a question that I had. What do we know about Chuck's mother up until this point? Like,
well, speaking as a newbie, I would say nothing, Karen.
Yeah, we don't really, we never see her or hear from her. She was always just with her dad in the yard. That's all they wrote.
Okay, good, because I was like, I don't remember anything. So I guess that makes sense if they never mentioned it.
I know what you mean. I was kind of going crazy for a second. I was like, wait. Okay, I'm thinking that there had to have been something about her by now, but I do not know what it would have been.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, oh, go ahead, Colleen.
Oh, well, just I think that's part of it, that they sort of slip that by you. They don't make any mention of her mother, like her mother wasn't involved in her life at all that she knew of. So it doesn't kind of, like, they don't tell stories of, oh, my mom, blah, blah, blah. So you don't wonder, like, wait a second, who is Chuck's mom? What happened to her? Until they just throw this at you in the finale and you're like, oh, my God.
And, you know, that feels a lot like J.K. Rowling's writing, because she would do that often. Uh-huh. Where, right, you know, she wouldn't mention a certain facet of a character. Dumbledore is a perfect example. And all of a sudden, when you learn about their past, it's like, oh, you actually do have a past and other relatives and things that affected you before the main character was introduced to your life. Yeah, and I mean, overall, I find the Jim Dale narration even more gorgeous, and I'm only saying this because this is my first episode of Pushing Daisies that I've been on and very watchable because of scheduling reasons, but I feel that that adds on to the J.K. Rowlingness of every episode, and every time that I hear his, the facts are these, I'm like, yeah, it gets you geared up and ready.
He should just narrate every show.
He should just narrate everything. He should narrate me walking down the street, thinking,
yep,
eating breakfast. That'd be great.
I would love that. Good. So we're all in agreement then that it was a good cliffhanger. And I was going to say that, like, it kind of adds to the fairy tale. Like, if you think of any, like, Disney movie even, or like you brought up, Mitch, the J.K. Rowling stories, like, you sort of just take it like, oh, there's only one parent. Okay, we don't really need to, like, think about it until it starts to become relevant with the backstory. Like, oh, her dad died and now she's with her aunts. Oh, wait a minute. There should be, another part to that story that we don't know anything about. So I thought, again, that it came, yes, it was a last minute thing. And the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, all right, well, they're just trying to, like, get us hooked. But I think around this time watching it, I was like, actually, you know what? That was a pretty good place to take the show. Cause it kind of like, she's always, Lily is always like the distant one and sitting in the corner, like, you know, eating pies. So
yeah,
I liked
that
she had something going on.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm so glad that it's Lily and not Vivian, because Vivian is so sweet and so loving, and you always kind of wonder, like, what's going on with Lily, why she's so sort of cold and bitter. And I think just opening up this, you know, leaving this cliffhanger is so exciting. Like, oh my God. And I keep saying, oh my God, but that's what I was saying at the time.
Did everyone else love that little crab from, like, Pirates of the Caribbean that came out?
Yes.
The little rock crab. I love rock crabs. They're always so adorable.
This one was extra super adorable.
It was. And the way it showed up on Olive's shoulder right at the last shot, it was just like, what's up, guys?
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of, perfect segue into the homeopathic drugs, when Chuck tells Olive, she's like, oh, this is just vanilla that I put in their pies. And then she dumps the entire bottle in there. There's been a lot of discussion on the podcast about, like, should we be concerned that Chuck is drugging her aunts to, you know, like, is that an issue we should really be concerned about? And I guess this week it kind of moved the story along because Lily overdosed kind of a little bit on the feel-good drugs, if you will. And she kind of was showing, like, a little, at least I saw it this way. You can just feel free to disagree with me. She was kind of like craving the pie a little bit. So I feel like since Vivian said that she's trying to get in shape to fit in her costumes again, that Lily kind of has a little bit of an addiction to the feel good drugs. What do you guys think?
Probably. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing. See, I'm really kind of split on this because on the one side, you know, secretly drugging somebody, even if your intentions are good, probably not a good thing. You should probably ask them if they need, like, medication for their depression and, like, work it out with a doctor and that sort of thing. But I think within the context of the show, it's fine. It is kind of funny, and I see why Chuck wants to do that. And I kind of like the idea, and this could be like a wrong interpretation, but that Lily is sort of addicted to the feeling of happiness. I mean, it's the drugs, obviously, but I would like to think that she wants to be happy. And even though it's hard for her, she sort of subconsciously knows, like, the pies bring her happiness, and that she wants to continue that feeling because she is very cold and distant. And I like the idea of her having some sort of emotion. So, probably not a good thing that she, like, OD'd on it, but I guess we'll see what happens once we go into season 2 and if she will continue eating the pie or if something will change. Who knows?
Well, how could she now that we've wasted all of our happy juice, right? But, Karen, I think that an essential question for us to ask ourselves about Lily is why she had to hide, you know, Chuck. And obviously that'll describe why she's so sad, why she wants to have a happy pie in the first place. But my question is more, why is Olive still all honky-dory and she's not addicted to the pie, it doesn't seem. She even as much as squirted the juice directly into her mouth, which is assumedly a high concentration of this happy juice. So why is Olive just like, is she already like immune to it because she's too happy or something? Or like what?
That would be my guess. I mean, she's always been sort of super bubbly. That's just kind of her personality. And I think like she just put a drop or two on her tongue. So I would assume that it's probably not really going to affect her.
She can't get any more chipper.
Yeah, really.
I agree.
Well, learning, there's chipper and then there's tripping out. She wasn't exactly seeing the rock crab. Although maybe she did. It was on her shoulder, so.
Maybe that's what she sees the whole time.
The rock crab. That's her best friend.
It's everything's moving. Everything's alive.
That's she needs best like friends and all these sorts of animals, Digby and our rock crab.
Yep. There we go. I was more concerned about, more than putting the drugs in the pie, was did anyone notice that Chuck had the little bottle in the pocket of her pajamas and gave it to Olive? Like, that seemed a little weird. Like, I keep this on me at all times.
Yeah, that almost felt like it was supposed to be in a play, like a set thing where someone would just have the prop in their pocket kind of deal.
That kind of makes sense to me, though, because she probably, I mean, she obviously doesn't want anybody discovering what she's doing. So keeping it on her at all times makes the most sense so that, like, Ned doesn't find it or something.
Plus, I think she makes the pies at night, doesn't she? Or, like, really early in the morning.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever we see her cooking, she's always in her, like, normal clothes. But maybe she was going to sneak down, but then realized she would run into Ned. All right. So going back to Chuck for a little bit this week, she has someone who's hot on the trail of her secret, the mole from two episodes ago, who can smell death on her, which is still really creepy to me. But did you, like, I know we kind of touched on this a little bit. I forget who commented on it a little earlier, but I personally just thought that storyline was so out there and like not it just never really worked for me. I remember even the first time watching it, I wanted him to go away, even though it's like kind of the first time we're having a recurring character and it's starting to like bring stories together throughout the series. I think it would have gone further had we had more than 9 episodes. But what did you guys think of the mole coming back and Chuck trying to like have someone to talk to?
Well, how creepy is it that he shaved Digby's behind? How did he like get to Digby? You know what I mean? Like he's a pretty sneaky dude.
Yeah, I think what you were saying about it being really one of the first characters that I've sort of come back from a previous very specific plot line, I think that's the one thing that sort of saved this plot line for me, because I felt like, okay, we were introduced to him for this reason, and yet here he is again for something related, but it's still different. And I feel like that just kind of, like you said, brought everything together. So in that sense, it worked for me. It felt a little anticlimactic, which I mentioned earlier, but I kind of liked the idea of somebody figuring out her secret, because Olive is kind of, you know, she doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't believe Chuck when she says what the truth is. And I think it makes sense that people will start to figure out what's going on and start to question things. And even though it's weird that he can like smell the death on her and everything, I mean, this is Pushing Daisy, so it's not that weird, but I liked the idea of somebody figuring it out, because I think that's realistic.
Yeah, I understand Chuck's desire to have someone who just someone she can talk to that's not immediately involved in her situation that didn't bring her back to life, like someone that she can open up to, who might be a little, you know, a little more understanding. But I just feel like she could have picked anyone else, anyone more trustworthy than Pee-wee Herman living in the sewers. Like, it's just like, I never got like, why would she just, I guess just because he shows some interest, some inkling of what's going on with her. Maybe that's why she thinks she can open up to him, but it's just like, no, Chuck, come on. Anyone else, please pick anyone else.
Is it weird I kind of like him?
No, I don't think so.
Dead silence.
Well, not for you, Karen, because I feel like you always find these pariahs and shows to like, so it makes sense.
Yeah, this is a thing that obviously has been happening for a while. If you listen to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, it's a thing. But the reason why I like him is because, I mean, he is kind of creepy, so I'm not saying that he's not weird, but I also feel like he just really wants to learn things, and he's just really interested in figuring out why she is so different. And so I found it as more of like a morbid fascination with her than like truly being really creepy. And I think that's why I kind of just enjoyed his character. Also because it kind of pushed her to be happy with Ned and happy with the fact that he's the one that knows her secret. And I guess, you know, that was sort of his point all along. Like the point of his character within the show to kind of push her in that direction. And the fact that he succeeded and she realized that, I just kind of enjoyed that.
And I don't think it's creepy that he figured out the way he did that Digby and Chuck are dead. But I feel that it reveals a little bit more about the exact physics of what happens when people are brought back from the dead. And the fact that there's something to the effect of ozone reeking off of them because their cells were once dead and now they're alive screams to me zombies. And I feel that the only difference between zombies and these characters are, A, we're lucky enough not to see any rotten, B, we don't have them wanting brains, and C, they seem to have their full facets back. But I feel that it's just really telling, and we need more of the science behind it. I want it, at least. But it's very telling to give us something specific like, yes, ozone comes off of your cells after you die, and that's what I smell on you, Digby. I feel that this mole situation is going to reveal more in the next season if they can fit it in amongst, you know, the writer's strike and everything else that's going on. Because I was really intrigued with what was going on scientifically with the guy smelling it on, you know, the two, and seeing that she smelled just like the dog. But it was kind of funny because didn't he say that Olive smelled like Digby? Because, no, just dog. Because Olive goes, what I smell like? And he just goes, dog.
Yeah.
All right. So go with Ned. I've mentioned before on this podcast that Chuck, like her, I don't know, I don't want to say this to be mean to Chuck or like, you know, a pessimist in life, but her optimistic like attitude has always kind of irked me the wrong way sometimes. I don't know. I guess it's the same reason why I don't watch New Girl. I don't like Zooey Deschanel's character on it, and Chuck I guess is kind of like prior to New Girl, you know. But depressed Ned, he really bums me out because I kind of always feel sad for Ned a lot of times during this rewatch, and now just watching him mope around, you kind of want to just slap him and say like, come on man, pull yourself together. What do you guys think? Can he get on with his life? Let's say Chuck were to disappear again. Like, would Ned just kind of die? That's the feeling I got.
I don't know if he really would. I think that he could probably get over it in time. But depressed Ned is really, really sad to watch. And kind of difficult sometimes because he cares about her so much, and he has all of this guilt, and it's somebody that he's known for his entire life, even though they did have that large amount of time that that they were apart, but it's somebody that he knows very well and obviously is very, very close to now. And I think that just, it shows you how much he cares about her and how much it affects him. And I like the idea that even though he's like trying to work, he's always really thinking about Chuck. And just to talk about like her optimism for a little bit, like I can see how that would be annoying sometimes, but I think what they do really well is balancing her optimism with the very sort of like passive characteristics of Ned. And I think that's why those two work so well together for me, because she pushes him out of his comfort zone and it kind of wakes him up and gets him to do things he normally wouldn't do. And I really enjoy that. But I think what was really hard for me in this episode was they were both sort of really sad and upset and depressed. And she wasn't optimistic and she was really kind of questioning a lot of things. And it made the whole episode, like, the tone of it was just really muted. And I don't think that's why I didn't like the episode, but it was definitely a change from the usual tone that we have, which is very bright and full of, you know, emotions. And usually Chuck and Olive are kind of running around with like this crazy optimism and high energy.
And I think that fit the snow setting as well, very well, because this was kind of the first time everything was a muted color. Like it was, there was a lot of white and not a lot of, just any sort of color involved, especially like in their overcoats, and everything was just the cover, like the covers hid all the color, I guess you could say. Even the, bees little jackets. I loved those little hive jackets were kind of colorless.
They're like tea cozies for bees.
Yeah, like tea cozies.
Aww.
Did anyone else feel Phantom of the Opera-y when Chuck is sitting crying in the graveyard for her father?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I took a note about that. But every time any scene of anything happens in a snowy graveyard, I always think of Phantom of the Opera or Harry Potter. And it's just so much sadness. I hate it.
It is. I have a question about the physics of that scene. Ned was able to put his coat onto Chuck. Does that mean, let's just say that he would have, I don't know, if Ned's hair was on his coat and that touched Chuck's bare skin, that would be okay? I mean, I assume if they're living in the same apartment that they would have figured that part out by now, but
I think it's like skin-to-skin contact, right?
What about like skin flex then? Like, is it, it has to be like still attached to his body, like his cells?
Yeah, I think it still has to be a part of Ned's.
That makes sense. Because like, I was nervous.
Attached to the rest of him. Yeah.
Because like when you put that coat under her, I was like, I caught my breath. I was like, no, don't.
They're such risk takers.
Oh, seriously. Like, even the saran wrap, like, come on, that stuff really could have broken very easily.
That would never hold up. Never hold up.
No, it wouldn't. They were, like, you know, going at it with their teeth and everything. I'm like, ah!
Yeah, I still get nervous watching it. Like, I watch every kind of move that they make. I'm like, oh my gosh, did their, like, their hands almost touch? Or did it, her arm was really close when she was reaching across him to make a pie? It's very, creates a lot of tension. So we're kind of in agreement. I sound like a downer, but I enjoyed seeing like Chuck kind of like taken aback in this episode. Just like she really needed time to like not be around Ned and not try to be, come on, Mr. Grumpy Pants, like we're gonna change. And it was nice for her to just like kind of sit and mope and sort of take in everything that's kind of been building up inside of her. Like, I can't see my aunts. I can't do this. I can't do that. Yet my dad is now the result of my boyfriend accidentally trying to save his mom. And I liked sad Chuck.
But what was she trying to do with her dad's skeleton? Like, was she gonna, could that thing even come to life anymore? Like, I don't know. It was frozen ground too. So I really don't know the logistics of what Chuck was thinking at this moment.
Yeah, I don't know.
She was just desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's, like, I think that there has to be, like, an expiration date on this. Like, I don't think, like, a bunch of bones can come back to life. Because at that point, it'd been, like, what, 20 years? So, I think that they couldn't have done it even if Chuck wanted to and Ned agreed to do it.
And I have to agree. I think that the defining characteristic for when there's the expiration date is perhaps when the nerves in the human body no longer connect to each other, because then you can't have an electrical, I guess, synapse to awaken the whole body at the same time from the brain down to the toes, you know?
That's a good point.
But
you're
what
really
about
bringing the science into this podcast?
I know.
I'm really into the science of the show, and that's why we're getting so much science in this episode of Rewatchable, because it's the first one I've been on. But I have another question, as long as we're talking science.
Sure.
Without taking some of the thunder from the mystery of the week, what happens when someone's body parts are separate? Is it only like the brain's part that's still connected to the brain? Like, let's just say the torso and up would still come alive, but if you touched a leg, it wouldn't come alive. I don't know. I feel like it's all down to the brain from what we're seeing, right?
Well, I think that kind of has to go with your nerve ending type thing. So mm-hmm. I feel like if he touched a severed foot, I don't think like the toes would start to wiggle.
No,
but yeah. I think it has something to do with like being connected to the brain.
Funny, you should talk about a severed foot and the like, because there was a lot of talk in the last episode of Pushing Daisies about phantom limbs and still feeling them when they're not there and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it makes me wonder what Pushing Daisies was trying to hint at there, because maybe they're trying to go contrary to my nerves thing, you know?
Yeah, but I think, like, I guess we can touch on kind of the mystery of the week when the wish-a-wish lady is kind of lying in the parking garage. I think that if he, like, you know, went over and touched the heel of her foot and as opposed to her head, I think we would have gotten a different no response at the bottom, and she would have been able to give her last wish at the top.
And I thought she was going to, because she looked like she was still kind of like rearing a little bit. Like, she had a look on her face like, I still have something to say, but she didn't.
Yeah.
And that sort of came up when, you know, Ned was going to touch the second insurance agent that died, and then they tipped over the gurney and he broke into a million pieces, and Ned was like, oh no, I'm not touching that. Like, that, you yeah. wonder what would have happened. Like, it sort of raised the question in everyone's mind, like, oh God, what would have happened if he touched that? All the little parts just wiggling around.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was referencing.
So in the middle of this episode, we had another sort of cliffhanger plot twist sort of thing. Emerson tried to brush it off, but in order to, like, connect with Ned in the car, he brought up the fact that he has a daughter. What do we think about that?
Yay, Emerson backstory. I think it's just exciting. I think it's just exciting to learn a little bit more about him. And I think that this falls in line with his character, that he's just kept it really close to him. He doesn't want to share it. And even though he mentioned it to sort of get a point across to Ned, he doesn't want to expand on it because it's his own private thing and he just doesn't want to share it. So I like the idea that he's opening up to Ned a little bit, even if it is reluctantly. But I think it also makes sense that he is so reluctant about it.
Didn't you guys love that character change, too, when you saw him become serious for, like, the first time in this whole entire show?
Yes.
Yeah, that was great. That moment where he kind of just had this look in his eyes, like he was looking off into the distance. And I was like, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, Emerson, I've said this once, I've said it 1,000 times. He is my favorite character on the show, and I love that they're giving him more to work with, because you sort of, a few episodes back in the episode Bitches, it was kind of like interesting enough to see him like react and sort of like, I'm kind of falling for this dominatrix-esque dog trainer. So you got to see a little bit of his emotional side there, even though it was kind of just a lust. But
plot
here,
twist, she's the mother.
Yeah. But here you get like a very personal like punch to the stomach. I thought it was like really fitting with the rest of the information that was coming out in this episode, and to give Emerson a chance to like get in on the action of longing and like wanting to talk to someone he no longer does. And it kind of goes mirrors Olive, where she's sitting in the pie hole and she kind of imagines having what's his name, the drug dealer, like a traveling salesman, come back and like whisk her off her feet. But I like that every character had something that they brought into this episode to kind of make it a little darker.
And didn't Ned react adorably to when Emerson became all serious? I love when Ned's trying to console someone and he talks really fast, kind of like me. That's probably why I like him so much. I just get him. Didn't someone tweet? Yeah, someone tweeted at us too that they really thought that I was like Lee Pace or something as a joke because of how similar our voices are. And I can't really hear it myself because it's my own voice. But do you guys see it at all? I don't know.
Was it Lee Pace? I thought they said that you were like Jim Dale, like the narrator.
Was it Oh, maybe I misunderstood.
Which obviously makes it even better.
Well, I'd like that, but I don't have a British accent, so that's a bit perplexing.
Maybe you should start.
Maybe one. I should.
All right, where are we? Oh, okay. So, yay, backstories. But this week, let's get into the murder of the week. So we had the Uber life insurance agents who were being picked off one by one because they refused to, I guess not refused, but denied this child the chance at getting a heart transplant, which on the surface seems like, oh, this is going to be really touching and emotional. But then you get into this kid's house and he understandably is the most miserable child alive. But I personally was so uncomfortable watching those scenes, especially the mother being like, are you here to give us free stuff? I was like, oh my gosh. Like after just like I saw The Fault in Our Stars last week and I'm like, this is not the type of cancer story I am used to witnessing.
I think like the mother really didn't bother me at all. I kind of just ignored her. But that kid was so annoying. And I get the idea that he has a miserable life and he's very sick and so he's not going to be the most optimistic person, that's fine. But like we were talking about last week, I think pushing daisies toes the line so many times about how they handle certain situations that people are in, and it really does make you feel uncomfortable. And I don't know if they're doing that on purpose to sort of like push the boundaries and see how much they can get away with. But considering this is a comedy of sorts, I have a hard time really thinking that that's their objective. So I wasn't surprised that he turned out to be, you know, such a jerk, because I just figured that there was going to be some twist on this kid who had heart problems. But at the same time, it's kind of sad that they had to go in that direction.
Alfalfa hair that always stuck up. I think that was supposed to reference how he's always like hanging out at his house and not really getting up and always having a bedhead or something, right?
Probably.
What movies was he watching? I'm sure that those had relevance to, like, the show's overall.
Yeah, I was wondering that, too. I don't know what it was, but I was trying to see if I could recognize it.
I was trying to see if there were Alfred Hitchcock movies, because there's a lot about the birds going on in Pushing Daisies.
Yeah.
It very well could have been. I mean, and it seems like he had a different one on different channels, because when he would flip the channels, it was still those old movie. So maybe he has like a Turner Classic Movie subscription package that we've never heard about or something.
Yeah. I wish they talked about it. I think I would have sympathized a little bit more with this kid if I knew more about him other than I'm miserable and my heart is a sack of whatever it was. So I don't know.
Maybe that can be like an Easter egg hunt that we can send our listeners on, because they can like kind of pause it, Google what they were actually watching, and see if we can come up with something.
And if they find out what it is, we give them a free heart.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say whose heart.
Better than any iTunes incentive that Ariana's ever come up with, huh?
Although maybe a little bit more morbid than some of her incentives.
Not if you're watching The Wizard of Oz.
That's true. So my question for this part is, were you guys surprised by who actually did it at the end? Like, are you thinking it was actually the mother, or did you have a feeling that it was going to be somebody else?
I mean, I've seen it before, so what do you
Do you remember your initial reaction?
I mean, not really. It was quite a few years ago. But I think all signs for me, like even rewatching it, I was still like, it was between the mother and the Wish-A-Wish. Only because Wish-A-Wish is so, she was like the only character this episode who, I mean, I guess Olive a little bit, but like who was so bubbly and just like trying so hard to like make things right. Whereas everyone else was sort of like Ned sunk into his depression instead of like trying to like talk it out with Chuck. And Chuck was sort of like pulling away and everyone was sort of like pulling away in every direction. Whereas this woman was the only woman who wanted to connect in some way and had a mission that she was on. Cause like the insurance agents gave up on this kid. His mom was sort of just like, all right, if you're not here to give us free stuff, get out. So I think Wish-A-Wish was easily number one, maybe tied for second if I were to push the mother a little more.
See, I figured that it wasn't the mother because all signs pointed to the mother. And right. So, although when the potato was in the tailpipe, I was like, wait a second, am I wrong about this? But
felt
like
it was so... Yeah, what a red herring, wasn't that?
Yeah, it was really good. I was like, it's so obvious it can't be true. And I figured it wasn't the kid because he really couldn't do anything. He was so sick. But I actually never thought about the Wish-A-Wish lady. And so by the end of it, I was really surprised that she ended up being the one to have killed them.
And you know, that potato and the tailpipe thing really made me paranoid because I was like, how often do I really check my exhaust pipe?
For potatoes.
For potatoes specifically. But I think it's really funny that the Wish-A-Wish lady would go as far as, you know, murdering people to grant his wish when he asked for a lap dance and she did a tap dance, okay? Maybe she misheard him, but I feel as long as we're weighing, you know, pro quid pro, giving a lap dance might be a little less deadly than murdering other people. I just really don't see where her seesaw is tipping in either direction. Not that I wanted to see her give a lap dance, mind you. But you get the point. Like, she was doing other things that could have easily, I suppose, much easier than murder, been solved if she was that desperate to make his wishes come true.
I mean, she was kind of crazy pants, you know? I mean, she was definitely tipping in that direction. So I guess I'm not really surprised that she took that extra step and took his quote-unquote wish seriously.
Yeah, that was just her own mental excuse, just so she can go about on a killing spree, really. And I'm sure she's harbored bad feelings towards insurance agencies over all these years. Yeah. That's kind of her business, so.
And what a stroke of luck that on her license, she was not only an organ donor, but a perfect match for him.
Yes. Oh, come on. Yeah, right?
I really liked that twist, and it makes me wonder if, I don't know if they would really like bring up this plot line again, but I would be really interested in finding out if it like does kind of change his personality at all. If he gets a new heart that's much kinder and peppier, if he'll be like a totally different person.
He may also be burying people in snowbanks.
Yes, that's
he might
also
be a murderer now.
Very good
quite
point.
A possibility.
But he was smiling amongst the surgery somehow, so I feel like that had to have led to us thinking, yeah, he's happy now. So I'm just going to cross my fingers that he's not going to go on a murderous rampage, much like his heart's original owner. This is like the classic thing of, like, get a baboon's heart, do you turn into a monkey?
I love that the monkey killed her, by the way. That was my favorite little moment where the monkey just wanted to like play with the ball on the stick and shift the car into gear.
In the narration of that part. And Bobo's wish was to play with the ball on the stick. Bam.
All right. Well, as great as this episode was, it was the season finale. But yeah, if you think about it, if this series had a season one that ran for 22 episodes, it is possible that it wouldn't have done as well in Emmy season. Just to give you like a little bit of what was actually on the air at that time. It did win. It won two Emmys for season one, but it was nominated for 12 Emmys including, so I think it won directing and it won, I forget what the other one was, but it was up against like all of these comedies. I think Desperate Housewives was still categorized as a comedy. I only know that because Will and Grace lost to Desperate Housewives all of the time during the Emmys, and it made me so furious every time I watched it. But 30 Rock was on, The Office was on, and while it didn't win, it was up against these like big names, like Alec Baldwin was nominated, and Kristen Chenoweth won that for guest star. That's what it was.
She won for the second season.
Yes. Yeah. That was second.
That's correct. Sad that they reference her as a guest star. I mean, I guess it puts her in like that Anne Hathaway, Les Mis category for winning something, but it just makes me really sad because I feel like she's a larger character in the show than just a guest star. She's like main cast to me. I don't know.
Yeah, or at least supporting actress.
Supporting actress.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. Because, I mean, like, guest star would be, like, the mole or anyone in the episode of the week. You know, like, the guy who had the blow-up doll girlfriend or something, right?
Oh, yeah.
He was really overlooked in the nominations.
Yes, he definitely was.
His story was so convincing. I was rewatching that episode. I was like, man, this guy, he fell hard.
You know, that was the slightly realistic looking plastic doll, I have to admit.
Yeah, it was.
I could see where the man might be confused. Should his brain already be deluded?
Yeah, I mean, plus I love the original way they brought her, you know, a doll in, where he was like, I just really wanted to use the carpool lane, so I ordered this dummy.
And people do that. I mean, I don't know where Pushing Daisies is really meant to be taking place, but I didn't know of carpooling as popular as it is in SoCal before I moved here. Do you guys know of anywhere else, any other cities that have really popular carpooling?
I know, like, when I was in San Francisco and, like, the Oakland area, it was really popular because my roommate actually was, like, in a carpool, and, like, when her carpool kind of ended, like, she had to find another one, and it was so easy for her to just be, like, getting in a carpool with people, and they weren't even people who she, like, worked with, but it was just, they were all going to the same area.
Wow.
So, yeah, I wouldn't have never done that with strangers, like, maybe coworkers, but... She was a little out there.
Yeah.
I have a question about this Emmy situation, because when I read this, it really surprised me that they were up for 12 Emmys. And maybe I'm just being pessimistic because the show hasn't really jumped out to me yet. But, I mean, other than being visually stunning, and I've always really liked the dialogue, I guess I was just surprised that they had so many nominations. And I was just wondering, like, if you guys... Like, what were the other categories, and do you think that they were just sort of submitting anything that they were hoping to get, or if they were, like, really founded nominations?
Well, Karen...
A lot of them were, like, creative arts Emmys, so they got, you know, that sort of thing. But also, the other one they won for the first season was music composition. And all of the actors were nominated. Lee Pace, Kristen Chenoweth, Anna Friel. I don't think Emerson was nominated, which is just unfair.
Yeah.
but like direction, writing, things like that, in addition to the actors. So yeah, I think that's pretty awesome that they got all those nominations for only 9 episodes.
Yeah, and that's why I added this little bit on here, because like if you think about it today, like in the reason it stuck out to me was because in this week especially, you're just getting floods of shows that are just being canceled. Like they've had their chance, they're just done. Whereas this show went into a strike, only aired 9 episodes, and was able to rack up this many Emmy nominations. Like even if they didn't win, they're just. As they say, it's an honor to be nominated.
Right.
So I thought that was just amazing, and I wanted to know what you guys thought about it, especially with the way television is now.
Well, maybe it was easy pickings because of the writer's strike itself.
Yeah, that is true.
And, you know, I find it interesting that a show like Pushing Daisies that we consider somewhat whimsical, but with an adult cast, very easily picks up all these Emmy nominations when Veronica Mars, a much darker and often very well-written show, almost, I'm not going to compare it apples and oranges between Pushing Daisies and Veronica Mars, but to say that Veronica Mars never earned an Emmy nom, to my knowledge, is a bit shocking, and I feel that that does have to do with the adult cast. But Karen, what do you think, since you run the Veronica Mars Rewatchable?
I mean, yeah, I think it's hard to really compare those two, but in terms of Pushing Daisies, I feel like everything that you said that they were nominated for are the things that really stuck out to me, like the acting and a lot of the visuals and the music, which is always phenomenal. So I guess it really does make sense in those terms, but you have a question here, like after watching it now, do you think it could be a contender today? And you reference like Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, which is like, you know, was really not that great. But the thing is, this show wasn't that long ago, but I feel like even in the last like 5 or 6 or 7 years, the writing on television shows have gotten so, so, so good. And I feel like the writing in this show is one of its weakest points. And maybe it's because they're trying to attempt to kind of put together too many genres and it's just not working out for me. But I feel like maybe it wouldn't have done as well today because of that, because we have so many shows on television now that are just absolutely phenomenal. And the writing is just really, really amazing that it makes me wonder if Pushing Daisies were to start airing right now, if it would maybe even have lasted for 2 seasons or if it would have gotten, you know, cut off at 1.
It is an interesting question because I think so much at the time, Pushing Daisies was so different from anything else that was on television, at least that I remember. And I think that really made it stick out come nomination time.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially in the visual categories, because the reason I included Once Upon a Time in Wonderland is because it was kind of notoriously known and commented on consistently for the awful CGI effects. I thought that they were so bad. And rewatching this show after finishing Once Upon a Time in Wonderland, I was like, wow, it has been 7 years. And I feel like Pushing Daisies is like light years ahead of how Once Upon a Time in Wonderland was handled.
Yeah, definitely.
So and I think it's funny because they're both ABC, and ABC is owned by Disney. Disney's pretty much known for its great CGI, even on its shows, like, for instance, Lost, though had excellent CGI for its time. Pushing Daisies had decent, I'd say, but it was really weird when Wonderland just had, like, early 2000s CGI. It just really kind of struck us all as odd with the pattern of the CGI in the shows previous to it.
Yeah, I felt like I was like watching it like in a Windows screensaver from like 1995, if that makes sense.
I know. Yeah, Kyle and I used to make fun of it a lot when it was still on. I kind of rejoiced a little bit when the show ended. I didn't even watch it, but just seeing like the promotional images and little clips and stuff, I was just like, that's what the Cheshire Cat's supposed to look like.
Yeah, I mean, it was okay. It was good. It's like, oh, it's done. That's all. It's done. I don't want to harp on it. Anyone else want to comment on that, or would you want to move on to favorite scenes and favorite lines?
There were some pretty good favorite scenes in this episode.
Yeah, yeah. There were. All right. So our favorite scenes from this week. My favorite scene was Ned and Emerson driving to stop the Wish-A-Wish lady, because it kind of like really showed like Ned in his like, I need to focus on driving really super fast through this parking garage, which I can barely handle at 5 miles an hour. And he's going like 50, and he's trying to talk to Emerson about like this really serious issue as they're going to get a killer. He's like, so really, you have a daughter? And Emerson's sort of like hanging on for dear life. And he's like, not now, Ned. And I thought it was just so funny, like trying to listen to Ned, like talk really, really quickly and like nervously about this, like have a personal conversation in like a heat of a moment type of situation.
Yeah, it was really cute because Emerson was like, you're slowing down just like my grandfather when he's driving, just drive.
Karen, what was your favorite scene?
Mine actually pretty much directly followed yours, and it was when the Wish-A-Wish lady, Madeline McLean, was being torn asunder. First of all, because that voiceover was just kind of hilarious, but also because I was not expecting, like, the bottom half of her body to be at one end of the car and the top half of her body to be at the other end. And I thought they were going to make like some sort of Wicked Witch reference with her feet sticking out of the bottom of the car. And then when I saw that she was like in two separate pieces, it's probably terrible of me, but it was kind of funny. And I liked the follow up as well with her heart going into the kid. I thought that was really appropriate.
She wasn't a very good killer, was she? She was very obvious, like, in her, like, bright red suit or whatever she was wearing, and going up in the middle of the day with other people around in a parking garage and just being like, okay, whatever, I have a bat I'm going to hit someone in the face with, and it has...
With her giant van.
Yeah, like, yeah. The van that like, screams her business, and I'm just like, okay, lady, you really are off your rocker. I don't know. I know what's caught you by now, but I mean, when they were, it was really weird because they were talking about people carpooling once again, carpooling and pushing daisies. They were talking about people carpooling or something, and how they were like near the person that was killed or something. I thought, and it was just really strange that she got away with as much as she did. But that's neither here nor there. But I guess that I'll go on to my favorite scene, and it was when we first see Chuck, kind of just lamenting on top of the rooftop alongside her beehives. I like the pretty little Christmas lights they had intertwined around the pillars up there. I found it to be gorgeous, and I loved that little set. It was just so pretty, and it really made me feel like I just wanted to be Chuck's best friend, consoling her during her grieving.
Could have been in almost another Phantom of the Opera scene
on
the rooftop, right?
That's probably why I liked it so much.
Colleen, what was your favorite scene?
I loved when they went to the morgue, and they always have these funny exchanges with the mortician or the medical examiner, whatever he is. I love every scene they have with him, but this one, Emerson started off by insulting his Christmas sweater and then went on to have apparently surprisingly strong feelings about holiday sweaters, saying he hates when... It doesn't understand why people give holiday sweaters, because you either have to change your outfit that you're wearing right then and there, or you have to wait a whole year before you can wear it again. And it's like, I just thought it was so random and so lovely that it was from Emerson to have strong feelings about, of all things, holiday sweaters.
Yeah, I absolutely loved that scene, and I tried really hard not to pick an Emerson quote for my favorite line this week, but it is from that exact scene when you first get like the close-up of the holiday sweater that the medical examiner's wearing, and it's like this woman with like her crossed fingers, like just leaning her head on top of like this like beautiful holiday pattern, and Emerson says, "That sweater is uglier than a chipmunk's ass."
Which is very specific, and I'm not really sure why he would know what a chipmunk's ass looks like in the first place. I was thinking of Chip and Dale, actually.
I love Emerson. So, closing out season one with an Emerson quote. Karen, what was your favorite?
Mine was between Ned and Chuck, and it's when Ned says, "Been looking," and Chuck says, "Been hiding." And it was this really sort of muted scene and very toned down compared to a lot of their other conversations. And I guess the reason why I liked it so much was because they didn't talk in complete sentences. They didn't say anything. You know, it was just two words each, and you kind of knew exactly what was going on in their mind completely. And I love the way that they can talk to each other like that, that they just sort of understand each other. And I think their relationship is one of the highlights of the show for me. And this was just, even though it was a sad scene, a perfect example of that closeness that they have.
Very adorable. I definitely liked that a lot.
Oh, that's cute. So, Mitch, what was yours?
Mine is when Ned is trying to get out of Olive, where Olive is hauling up Chuck. Olive says, amongst a flurry of, "I know what you know," Olive says, maybe I know I have a tell, and I know you know I have a tell, and maybe I'm doing it now to confuse you because you don't know what tell I'm telling.
I love dialogue in this show. It's so good.
That's cute. Yeah, I love those little moments. I love how fast they talk. It's almost Gilmore Girls-esque.
Exactly. I was just going to say it.
There we go.
Yeah, and that whole scene was, like, just perfect because, like, you're kind of used to Ned going off on little tangents like that and to have mm-hmm. him trying to, like, get an answer out of Olive and then Olive, like, hitting him back with her, like, rambling, which it felt so right and perfect, and I loved that part, too.
Yeah, I love when Olive has little quips, like, when she first meets the traveling salesman and she's talking about, like, he's like, I have a comment. She's like, indifferent comment or good comment or something, right? Like, I love those little moments where she just has just enough spunk and sass to even someone she's at conflict with to be funny and kind of one-up them.
Mm-hmm. And Colleen, you also had a favorite line from Olive this week. What was it?
Yes, I love it. When she comes in and Ned is immediately, she's trying to have a nice conversation starter, and he's immediately trying to get information from her because he only cares about Chuck and where Chuck is and what's going on with her. So Olive says some comment about how cold it is and you could use a witch's bosom as a hot water bottle on a day like today. Ned asks about Chuck, and Olive proceeds to have a whole conversation with herself, but really pretending to be Ned and saying, and how are you today, Olive? I'm fine. Thanks for asking, Ned. That was a funny joke about the witch's bosom, Olive. Well, thanks, Ned. And I appreciate you using the word bosom. Why, Ned? Because it's less offensive than other words? No, I simply like the word bosom. I say it to myself all the time. Bosom, bosom, bosom. I just can't help myself. I'm a bosomaholic.
Bosomaholic.
Then he's like, are you done?
I didn't think masturbation meant chewing.
Oh, so great.
She is, and she definitely deserved all of the awards and accolades and mentions that she got. All right.
Perfect. Like, I feel like there's a little bit of Olive Snook in all of us. Like, just that, you know, feel like other people, like, nobody cares what you have to say. Like, why is everyone else doing this? No one's paying attention to me, so I'm just going to have this conversation with myself. I just thought it was great.
That is great. Well, that's a wrap on season one, guys. Are you ready for season two?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really odd doing this short of a rewatchable show because Veronica Mars was only halfway into its first season at this point, and to be completely done with season one is just kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, and season two is going to be equally as short almost. It's only 13 episodes, right?
Right.
13.
Which goes to show that if this show had this great of an influence, much like Firefly, that even though it was short, it really packed a punch.
Yeah, and it's still being, like, fought over today. Like, they wanted to bring it to Broadway, or they wanted to do, like, after the show was over, they were going to do comics, but then the publisher went out of business, and there's always a fight going on to bring it back in some capacity. So we're right on target bringing it back with Rewatchable. Mm-hmm. So we have just a little bit of listener feedback this week. Not a lot of commentary, but we're going to change that for season two. I'm going to try to come up with some more incentives, I think, for season two. Get people in on the conversation. So on Twitter, we asked if you had Ned's power for a hot second and could only bring one person back from the dead, who would you bring back? And we had Gertrude at Mitekib. Pliv. I'm sorry if I butchered that, which I definitely did. She said, I think I prefer them in their graves. Having them back for only 1 minute would be kind of traumatic. Greater than a minute, I'd be even worse. I think I have to agree. I don't think a minute would be enough time. It would be too painful. Sort of like Chuck bringing back her father for only a minute and having 20 years worth of emotional buildup for that. So I say I have to agree with Gertrude.
And for Chuck and Ned, 1 minute wasn't enough. As you can see, if there's a past and a history between, you know, Ned and the person he's waking up, it's going to be a lot more emotional. It's not going to be as easy as touch your dead. And even then, sometimes they find it kind of hard to, you know, get rid of some of the people. Like, there's one guy that started to lament with him about the situation with Chuck, and he started to talk about it, her, and he was like, you know, it's a long story. And then Everson just grabs his hand and shoves it on the guy.
Yeah, I think bringing somebody back, like, even if your intention is only 1 minute, like, it would be so tempting to keep them around, but the consequences are so high that I would definitely be feeling even worse as well.
And, you know, I'd say Ned's pretty lucky that the curse of whoever stays alive for one more minute than they were supposed to kill someone else thing doesn't affect him, because he doesn't really seem to worry about it, but Emerson's always, like, kind of freaking out because, you know, he's just hanging out next to him. I feel like Emerson really has to have, like, some kind of escape pod at this point, because it really seems like it's too close of a coincidence that it's, like, ticking down to the clock and, you know, the person's about to be alive more than 1 minute.
Those are some of my favorite scenes when he's, I think, really in the beginning of this season, when he's, like, running out of the funeral home, yes, trying to get as far away from Ned as possible when he gets, when the coffin gets locked. That is one of my favorite Emerson moments.
Emerson plays a lot of Russian roulette with Ned. Just, Ned is a very large emotional roller coaster, and you never know what he's going to think or do, because he likes to hold it all up, but when he feels, he feels.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree. Well, thank you for popping in on Mother's Day, and this episode won't be up on Mother's Day, but we're all here, ignoring our moms on Mother's Day to talk with you all.
It was perfect for Mother's Day. Lily's a mother. We learned that.
Lily is a mother.
Oh, wow, you're right.
Happy Mother's Day to Aunt Mom Lily.
Yes.
Aunt Mom
Happy
Lily.
Happy Mother's Day. So we can look forward to learning more about their past in season two. So that's it for us. I am Brittany.
I'm Karen.
I'm Mitch.
And I'm Colleen.
Thanks, guys. See you next week.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.